Tonight, health scare fallout after that jarring video of Hillary Clinton becoming ill. Tonight, her campaign under fire. Why did it take 2 days to disclose she had pneumonia? Aides now admitting mistakes, promising more medical records are coming. Is it a turning point after years of bloodshed in Syria? A U.S.-Russia mega deal finally stops the bombing. But can it last? Caught on camera, an arsonist torches a Florida mosque, a congregation shaken in a hunt for who set the fire. Fatal crash involving a high school football team. A frightening accident, once again raising questions about seatbelts. And the price you pay. Imagine instead of paying for medical costs, the insurance company pays you. We'll show you how patients are saving big. Nightly News begins right now.
From NBC News World Headquarters in New York, this is NBC Nightly News with Lester Holt.
Good evening. The Clinton campaign is vowing to release more information about her health as they face questions of whether they were trying to keep her diagnosis with a case of pneumonia a secret. The revelation came hours after Clinton appeared unsteady on her feet as she was being escorted from yesterday's 9/11 memorial here in New York. The campaign, which first attributed her illness to the heat, is now admitting they were slow to publicly disclose her condition. Tonight, she is off the campaign trail, resting at home, and our Andrea Mitchell has the latest.
Tonight, Hillary Clinton out of sight, recovering from pneumonia, canceling a California trip. After that video showing her nearly collapsing, leaning on Secret Service agents after abruptly leaving the 9/11 memorial service. Aides now admitting they did not give the public enough information about her condition and will disclose more.
We could have gotten more information out more quickly, and that's on the staff, that's on us, and we regret that.
The campaign under fire after first saying Clinton was simply overheated and dehydrated. Clinton telling aides she did not want to go to a hospital, but to daughter Chelsea's apartment, later leaving to go home.
It's a beautiful day in New York.
It wasn't until 8 hours after she left the ceremony, and after the video had gone viral, that the campaign revealed she had been diagnosed with pneumonia on Friday, 48 hours earlier.
Would you ever have disclosed it if we had not seen that video?
I can't speak to any hypotheticals other than what happened, which is, you know, clearly she needed some downtime.
Why not tell people when you learned that she had pneumonia?
We were focused on getting her to her doctor and making sure that she was okay.
Tonight, Clinton phoned into CNN to deny that she has frequently become dehydrated.
I think really only twice that I can recall. You know, it is something that has occurred a few times over the course of my life.
A week ago, Clinton had coughing spells, she said from allergies.
So, you got some water?
Yep.
Thank you. I'll be right.
Both 68-year-old Clinton and 70-year-old Donald Trump have faced calls to release more medical information. Trump has only released a few paragraphs from his doctor, Clinton considerably more detail, but still less than past nominees. In 2008, then 72-year-old John McCain allowed reporters to look through thousands of pages of medical records because he was suffering from recurring melanoma, a potentially fatal cancer.
Tonight, Clinton tweeted her thanks to well-wishers, saying that she's feeling fine and she's feeling better. She's getting better. And at the same time, the campaign announced that Bill Clinton will fill in for his wife tomorrow and the next day on the West Coast. Lester.
Andrea Mitchell. Thank you, Andrea. And we want to bring in now NBC News medical contributor, Dr. John Torres. He is an emergency room physician. John, after seeing that video and then the statement from Secretary Clinton's doctor and what the campaign is saying, how serious is this condition and how long does it take to recover?
You know, Lester, when it comes to pneumonia, I always treat it very, very seriously for a couple reasons. Number one, for some people, they're going to recover on their own, either with antibiotics or if it's viral, their body's going to take care of it. But for some people, especially as we get older, if we have other health issues, it could actually prove fatal. And so you want to be very careful with this disease and make sure it's treated appropriately. As far as recovery, that's going to depend on a few factors. Number one, how big is the pneumonia? Number two, how long did it take to actually get treatment started? And number three, what's the person's own health condition? oxygen. If it's a walking pneumonia, like what possibly happened here, that means they weren't hospitalized, so it's a mild to moderate kind of pneumonia. That usually recovers over a 10-day to 2-week period, but that's assuming antibiotics are started early on, and that's also assuming they did a 3 to 4 day rest period where we do very strong rest, meaning they go home, they stay on a couch, they maybe do puzzles, they just putter around a little bit, and then they do another 7 days to a week and a half of light duty. They have to keep an eye on their own body, though. If their body's starting to tell them that they're needing more rest, they need to slow down. If they don't get that rest, then they're going to either have one thing. It's going to extend the pneumonia, or they're going to collapse. Lester, all that right. might have been what happened here.
Dr. John Torres, thank you. Meantime, as health becomes a major topic in this campaign, Donald Trump has released even less information about his medical history than Hillary Clinton has. Now Trump says he'll, too, be releasing more information. At the same time, Trump is firing back after Clinton called half his supporters a, quote, basket of deplorables. We get that end of the story from NBC's Hallie Jackson.
Trying to show he's transparent, Donald Trump's promising to share the results of a recent physical.
I'll be handing out a paper with very large numbers of very detailed, hopefully good statistics.
It's not clear what Trump will reveal or when, though he's set to appear on the Dr. Oz show later this week, attempting to prove not just that he's healthy, but that he's not hiding anything. Still, he's released less information than Hillary Clinton has, whether it's on medical records or taxes. Trump today largely laying off questions about Clinton's health.
I just hope she gets well and gets back on the trail.
Trump instead excoriating her on something else. What Clinton said Friday night.
You could put half of Trump's supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables. The racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic.
The disdain that Hillary Clinton expressed toward millions of decent Americans disqualifies her from public service.
Both sides eager for this fight. While Clinton's walking back the number of supporters she called deplorable, she's standing by the label itself. Trump's team calculating, for her, this could be as damaging as Mitt Romney's 47% comment last cycle. His campaign out with a new ad, pouncing faster than they ever have before.
Viciously demonizing hardworking people like you.
But for a confrontational candidate, possible political risk, as a new poll shows 60% of Americans think Trump is biased against women and minorities.
It could remind many voters about his extreme supporters and about his intolerant comments over the past year.
Late tonight, Clinton on Twitter hit Trump's running mate, Mike Pence, who declined to call former KKK leader David Duke deplorable. But Pence did clearly denounce the support of Duke and anybody else who thinks like him. Lester?
All right, Hallie Jackson, thank you. Overseas tonight, a fragile ceasefire is holding in Syria. After so long, the bombing has finally stopped after a hard-fought deal struck by the U.S. and Russia. But the questions this evening, can it hold and can relief reach so many families trapped by this war? We get the latest from our chief foreign correspondent, Richard Engel.
For the battered city of Aleppo, a pause today in the relentless bombing. But will it last? People came out to shop and to play, because at sunset, a hard-negotiated U.S.-Russian ceasefire came into effect. Across Syria, both regime forces and relatively moderate rebels are supposed to hold their fire for a full week, allowing humanitarian aid. God willing, this truce will hold. Give us some relief. Enough, one woman told us. Don't trust the regime, cautioned a man. Aid agencies also have many questions.
But exactly who is going to be allowed to get the aid in, what the approval process is going to be, what the mechanism is going to be, we're still waiting for some of those details.
It's so complicated because there are so many armed forces involved in this war, and only some of them have agreed to stop shooting. The Syrian regime has the support of Russia, Iran, and Hezbollah, a Lebanese militia. On the other side are Islamist and secular rebels, the Kurds, ISIS, and a few hundred American advisors there to fight them. It's a puzzle with mismatched pieces. And today, Syrian President Assad promised that his troops will liberate every inch of Syria. It hardly sounds like peace is in the air. Still, today, Secretary Kerry was cautiously optimistic.
The earliest reports are that there's a some reduction in violence.
A much-needed evening without bombs, but few are even daring to hope that this is the beginning of the end of a vicious war. There are already some accusations that this truce is being violated. Lester, I think we'll know if it's working, if over the next 48 hours or so, the aid convoys are allowed to reach places like Aleppo. If only that happens, it will be welcome relief to the people. But is it the start of the end of the war? Not a lot of optimism.
I think the world holds its breath. Richard, thank you. Back home, investigators have released surveillance video of a possible suspect in a fire they believe was deliberately set at a Florida mosque. That same mosque had been attended in the past by the Orlando Pulse nightclub shooter. Now our Kerry Sanders explains authorities are asking, was this arson a hate crime?
With just minutes to go on a solemn date, 9/11, an arson fire at a Florida mosque, a likely hate crime, say agents. At the same mosque where Pulse nightclub gunman Omar Mateen occasionally worshipped. Tonight, investigators have a useful clue to find the arsonist. A security camera caught a man running from the scene, that arm waving, say officials, possibly because he burned himself when he set the fire. Whoever it was came on a motorcycle. 911 calls came in shortly after.
It looks like a church. I'm assuming it's a church.
You see flames coming from the roof?
Yes, and I see, like, a whole bunch of smoke.
Witnesses say the fire spread quickly.
We have one commercial structure. It's about 25% involved with this time, flame through the roof.
This morning, more than 100 members of the mosque had planned to hold service here for Eid, the holiest of days in the Islamic faith.
Allah.
Instead, this morning, they hastily joined a congregation at a nearby mosque.
Everybody's obviously saddened and scared about it, but you know, our community is bigger than a building.
Ever since Omar Mateen, claiming allegiance to ISIS, killed 49 people at a gay nightclub in Orlando, there have been numerous threats and violent attacks at the Fort Pierce Islamic Center. In July, a member was beaten up by a stranger in the parking lot.
It's unacceptable to try to think that because of the actions of one criminal individual, the others would have to be somehow be held accountable for it. That's un-American.
Tonight, with the possibility the arsonist may have burned his arm, authorities are checking with local hospitals and hoping if somebody knows something, they give the police a call. Lester?
All right, Kerry Sanders in Florida tonight. Thank you. A devastating house fire in Memphis has claimed the lives of 9 family members. Among the dead, 3 adults and 6 children, ages 3 to 16. A 4th child is fighting for life tonight. Authorities say this is the single deadliest fire in Memphis since the 1920s. The cause remains under investigation. A horrific crash in Colorado is raising more questions about the safety of our nation's school buses. The driver was killed and several members of a high school football team were injured when their bus veered off the road and slammed into a concrete pillar at Denver's International Airport. NBC's Miguel Almaguer has the latest.
Loaded with a high school football team, the head-on crash was so violent, driver Kerry Chopper died on scene. 3 adults suffered serious injuries, at least 15 students sent to the hospital. Police still don't know why the bus veered off the road at Denver International Airport.
The tire tracks did not show any sign of left or right turns, simply drove straight off the roadway into that pillar.
With students and staff grieving, tonight new questions over safety. Michelle Crawford refuses to let her children ride the bus because they have no seat belts.
I don't think it's a lot to ask for a 3-point lap shoulder belt that they're using in their car every single day.
Though school bus crashes are rare, the accidents are high profile. 29 were hospitalized after a rollover in Indiana. In Houston, 2 children killed when their bus veered off an overpass. 26 million children ride one every day. From 2005 to 2014, more than 1,300 people were killed in school transportation crashes. Federal law does not require, but federal officials now support seatbelts on every bus.
Lives will be saved if we put 3-point belts on buses and they are used.
School buses have long been the safest way for children to get to school. But tonight, many say more needs to be done to keep kids safe. Miguel Almaguer, NBC News.
Much more to tell you about tonight. Still ahead, slashing sky-high medical costs. How to shop around for the treatment you need and get the insurance company to actually pay you for it. Also, flu season's just around the corner. We've got a warning about the dangerous mistake so many parents make when giving their children medicine. We're back now with a new effort to get skyrocketing health care costs under control by paying patients to choose the most cost-effective option. With health care costs expected to rise another 6.5% both this year and next, some employers and insurers are encouraging customers to shop around, even giving them a kickback on the savings. Here's NBC's Tom Costello.
The drug treatment Paula Bennett receives every 8 weeks for her Crohn's disease should require a $30 insurance copay. Instead, she's the one getting the cash.
But I'm not paying that. I'm making money.
Making money because she's treated at this New Hampshire clinic rather than a more expensive hospital nearby.
I get $500 for the Remicade infusion every time I go in for the treatment.
They pay you $500.
They pay me because the savings is that substantial to the insurance company.
Very substantial. The treatment costs $4,000 at the clinic, $40,000 at the hospital. It's called Smart Shopper, used by a small but growing number of employers and insurers to drive down medical costs by giving patients a cut of the savings on standard treatments and surgeries, from lab work to colonoscopies, knee replacements to MRIs. Not cancer, not heart surgery. In Miami, for example, gallbladder surgery can cost anywhere from $5,000 to $19,000, depending on the facility. Yet both are highly rated.
If I choose to have my gallbladder removed here, which is a cheaper option, you're going to send me a check for $150 because of the savings.
Correct. And it will cost you less as well. You're out of pocket.
Some health advocates worry that paying patients might persuade them to choose cheaper and low-quality care. But several studies have shown the best care often isn't the most expensive. Yet very few patients shop around.
We have no idea if that bill is going to be $20 or $400. Where else in your life do you shop that way?
Patients choose the highest rated and most cost-effective options. Paula is convinced she gets better care at a small clinic.
This is really about your quality of life.
Yes, it is.
And you get paid for the treatment.
I do.
Need anything else?
No copay and pocketing $3,000 a year. Tom Costello, NBC News, Bedford, New Hampshire.
We're back in a moment with the unlikely way a would-be presidential assassin spent his first full day of freedom. The man who attempted to assassinate President Ronald Reagan is now free from a mental hospital after decades. John Hinckley Jr., now 61 years old, was released over the weekend to the home of his elderly mother in Virginia. He was spotted yesterday shopping at a Target store. A judge ordered his release after declaring that psychiatric treatment has been effective and Hinckley has no signs of any violent tendencies. An alarming new warning for families as flu season draws closer. A new study finds that over 80% of parents have accidentally given children the wrong dose of liquid medicine, which can cause an overdose. Researchers suggest using an oral syringe because the odds of making a mistake are four times less than using dosing cups that come with medicine bottles. You'll be seeing some new faces live from New York this fall. Saturday Night Live announced today it's adding three new players to the cast for the upcoming 42nd season. Comedians Mikey Day, Alex Moffat, and Melissa Villaseñor. They'll likely be featured players, some fresh additions following the departures of cast members Jay Farrow, Taron Killam, and John Rudnitsky. When we come back, the inspiring story of a man working with a former president to give nearly two dozen families a roof over their heads. Finally, tonight, the race is on in Memphis to build nearly two dozen homes for families in need. The man leading the effort truly knows the value of having a home to call your own. And he's getting help from a former commander-in-chief. NBC's Gabe Gutierrez has more on someone who is inspiring America.
Just north of downtown Memphis, home is a little sweeter.
I think my greatest joy definitely is seeing the families get the keys to the home.
Dwayne Spencer is the local president and CEO of Habitat for Humanity, now working side by side with President Jimmy Carter to house 21 families this fall.
Everyone deserves a decent place to live.
He would know better than most.
Did you realize what type of poverty you were in?
I did. And I was embarrassed by it.
In the early 80s, his family lived in crippling poverty, in a shack with almost no running water in rural Tennessee.
Their home burned down when he was 16. This is the first time he's returned in years.
I'm thinking that we used to walk down this hill to actually use the bathroom. It makes me emotional.
His steep climb took him from a mailroom to graduate school.
It was the beginning for me to be able to move out of that situation into something, into the 21st century.
The past still haunts Maria McKinney, who remembers the day she couldn't make ends meet and learned she and her kids would be evicted. Until Habitat and Dwayne Spencer gave her much more than four walls.
Our family needs a good, stable home to raise their children in.
Under Spencer's leadership,
hey John.
Habitat has tripled in size.
I don't think your past is completely indicative of what your future will be.
In some ways, he's come quite far from his humble beginnings. In others, he's never felt closer. Gabe Gutierrez, NBC News, Memphis.
And that will do it for us on a Monday night. I'm Lester Holt. For all of us at NBC News, thank you for watching, and good night.